Well, we are, everybody, I'm Joel Kuipers in the Department of Anthropology. I'm a professor of anthropology and international affairs here at GW. And I've been quite fortunate to collaborate with the Indonesian Consortium for Religious Studies for many years, of which Bernie is a founding member. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So I'm very delighted to have with us today Bernie Adane Risakota, who comes to us with a very interesting background. He was born in China to a mission family. He's affiliated with the Presbyterian mission of the Presbyterian Church, but he earned a BA in English and Asian Studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he received his PhD in International Relations and Ethics from the Graduate Theological Union at University of California, Berkeley. He taught at Berkeley for many years before becoming a founding director of the ICRS, which is the Indonesian Consortium for Religious Studies, which is a consortium of Christian and Muslim universities that carries out research on religion in Indonesia. And I have been affiliated with it and have had a NSF grant that just ended a year ago, but we were fortunate to use ICRS as our base, for which I'm very grateful. And it's a very vibrant center for intellectual debate and hosts many foreign scholars at various times. Bernie is a faculty member at the Universitas Duta Wacana also, and a core faculty member of the ICRS in Yogyakarta. The ICRS is based at Gajah Mada University. Bernie was a visiting fellow at St. Edmund's College, Cambridge University, and at the International Institute of Asian Studies in Amsterdam. And he's done research on religion, power, and violence in Indonesia at various times. He's the author of many books and articles, including Strange Virtues, Ethics in a Multicultural World, which was published in 1995, and now most recently, Living in a Sacred Cosmos, Indonesia and the Future of Islam, which he will be speaking to us about today. So please join me in welcoming Bernie.
Okay, well, I think I will just sit down. You can all see the screen if I sit down here. So I'm delighted to be with you, and thank you very much to Joel at short notice, mm-hmm. Setting this up, and to the Sigur Center that has hosted us here. Probably you all know that Islam is growing fast in the world. It's currently 23% of the population of the world. That's equal to the combined population of China and the United States. In a few more years, there will be about 30% of the population of the world will be Muslim. So a real question is, what is the future? What's the future of Muslim relations with the West? Particularly, what is the relation between different religious groups that often in recent times have been the cause of conflict and strife? Just a quick question. This is a quiz, pop quiz here. Anybody know how many islands there are? Joel, I'm sure, knows. How many islands there are in Indonesia?
10,000.
17. Okay. 17, yeah. 17,000 is the winner of the $64,000.
Depends on high tide or low tide.
Right, well, actually, the real answer is nobody knows, because, again, it may depend on high or low tide, but I think it doesn't count rocks, so it'd be a lot more if they just counted rocks. So But there are about 6,000 islands that are inhabited, which means they have a water source. Generally means they have a freshwater source for people to drink. It is the largest. Thank you. It is the largest Muslim country in the world, by far, with more Muslims than the whole Middle East put together. But a lot of what scholarly attention has focused on in Indonesia is the rise of radicalism, the increasing intolerance, the discrimination against minority groups, and the eclipse of forms of Islam that were associated with the Abangan or the peasants who practiced a kind of folk Islam that was very tolerant and very sometimes accused of being syncretistic, mixed with lots of local beliefs and rituals and practices. This kind of came to a head recently with huge demonstrations against the Chinese Christian governor of Jakarta, Ahok, as he's known, his nickname, that brought somewhere between 500 and 700,000 people demonstrating in Jakarta. Also, there is in the fairly recent past, from between 1998 and 2002, during those 4 years particularly, there was a lot of conflict in many different parts of Indonesia. In 1998, Suharto fell from power, and Indonesia restructured, decentralized power, instituted democratic institutions and mechanisms, passed laws defending human rights and many things that were very exciting. It was called the Reformation period, Reformasi. But at the same time, it also triggered conflicts all over Indonesia because there was no longer an authoritarian, militaristic central government to suppress all conflict and to not allow the extremes to exist in Indonesia. The Suharto government outlawed the left and the right, and they if you wanted to live peacefully in Indonesia, you needed to be on board with Suharto's development agenda. So there were a lot of conflicts, and the worst during those years were conflicts between Christians and Muslims. Although Madura and Dayak was pretty close second, but there were a lot of both ethnic and religious conflicts in various parts of Indonesia. This is all introduction for me. It's not what my talk is about. Because this is what the media, and this is what a lot of scholarly focus is on this. It's on the problem of intolerance, of violence, of Wahhabism. We were just talking for 2 hours almost at the State Department, and very much focused on the concern of the spread of Middle Eastern forms of Islam in Indonesia. But I've been working on some ideas for around 20 years, and I begin the book that has finally come out with this quote: "Everything we see hides another thing. We always want to see what is hidden by what we see." My book is an attempt to look at what is hidden by the focus that I think is shaped by fear of Islam, some not completely irrational fear of Islam, but I think the fear of Islam has really shaped the discourse and the understanding of Islam in Indonesia, especially in the scholarly literature, although probably even more so in the press, where you don't hear about Indonesia, you never hear about Indonesia unless we have violence or a disaster. Now we're in the news because we just had a big earthquake and tsunami in Sulawesi that is going to have thousands of casualties. It's now 1,400, I think they're saying, but it's definitely going to be much higher than that. Part of my interest in writing this book was stimulated by Charles Taylor, the philosopher who wrote, he's written many books, but the one that really stimulated me the most was his book, A Secular Age, which in about 1,000 pages sort of outlines the development of what he calls the secular age in the West. And I found the book very interesting because he doesn't just focus on worldviews, on ideas, but he focuses on imagination, on what people imagine to be reality. And the imagination of reality is not just ideas, but also includes art, includes symbols, it includes stories, it includes rituals and practices. It includes a whole lot of things that, according to Taylor, are formed intersubjectively. They're not just objective. They're not just subjective. They are socially constructed by people who are living with one another. And the thing that struck me about Taylor's account, his story about social imaginaries in the West, is that even though these social imaginaries are obvious in Indonesia too, they helped me understand the West, but they're also obvious in Indonesia too. But they're not necessarily and certainly not always the dominant imagination of reality that is held by most Indonesians. There's tremendous diversity of imaginations of reality. This is a picture of some young people at, these are Muslims, at a Vespa festival where they modify their Vespas to make them look like something out of Mad Max. These are some other young people who are wearing Flores clothing after they came out from church, young people after church. The way people imagine reality, the way they feel about what is real, is shaped by a whole lot of different things. Of course, this calls to mind Jose Casanova and his discussion of multiple modernities, that modernity in Indonesia is not the same as modernity in the West. It's not even the same as modernity in Singapore or Malaysia or Japan or anywhere else. There are multiple modernities that are being shaped and are always in process. One of the realities of social imaginaries in Indonesia is shaped by really rapid social change. If you can imagine how fast things are changing in the United States, I mean, no one would have imagined Obama would become president a few years before him. Nobody would have imagined Trump would become president a few years later. When I moved to Indonesia, there was no internet. There was only one television program with only Suharto on it. And now, you know, this picture is a symbol of rapid social change. Not too many Indonesians live in houses like that, but some do, some still do. But even if they live in a house like that, they have a parabola in front and they're watching CNN inside. So the scale of change that they're experiencing, I remember when I was teaching at the State Islamic University, Sunan Kalijaga, and I was kind of amazed to find out that some of my students who had come from Pesantren background, very traditional, very simple Indonesian traditional Muslims, they had formed a study group to study Michel Foucault. and they were reading French social theory and trying to understand the world not only through the eyes of Islam, but also through the eyes of postmodern French critical philosophy. So it's a country that's amazing and interesting because of all the variety there is and the rapid social change that's going on there. Nobody knows what the future will hold for children like these. They are facing a world that I can make one confident prediction. One confident prediction. In 10 years, the world will be like nothing any of us has yet imagined. None of us has imagined it. We don't know what's coming. And what happens in Indonesia is deeply influenced by what happens elsewhere. So it's not a matter of just knowing Indonesia and predicting what's going to happen in Indonesia, because what happens in Indonesia is affected by what happens here in the United States, in Washington, in the Middle East, in Europe, and so on. That earlier demonstration I showed you a picture of, that was about 1 week after President Trump was elected president here in the United States. And it's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence. The largest Muslim country of the world that is proud of Islam, of their status as the largest Muslim country, they are demonstrating against having a Christian and a Chinese leader, the second most powerful person in Indonesia. It's amazing that he was elected. There is reactions against the rhetoric, the anti-Islamic rhetoric, and the fears of Islam that are coming out of other parts of the world. Another theme in my book, Living in a Sacred Cosmos, Indonesia and the Future of Islam, is that Indonesians are shaped by at least four kinds of cognition. Merlin Donald has a theory of cognitive evolution, which he posits human intelligence and cognition evolved from mimetic cognition to mythic cognition to theoretic cognition. Theoretic cognition being the kind of lodestone of the modern world. I've added another, fourth, moral, because I think I've been always struck by Indonesia as being one of the most moralistic countries in the world, where people think a lot in the categories of right or wrong, forbidden, haram or halal, permitted or not permitted, good or evil, legal or illegal, against adat or not. They're always thinking in categories that have to do with right and wrong and good and evil. So I think you can make a case that that is a separate way of thinking. It's not the same as mimetic, mythic, moral, or theoretic. Bob Bella, who was my colleague and mentor in Berkeley, he took up these three types of cognition, mimetic, mythic, and theoretic, and he uses them to analyze the development of the modern world by taking up the theory of axial civilizations. Axial civilizations, which were posed by Carl Jaspers at the end of World War II, in reaction to the theory that modernity is a Western invention that is the product of Christianity. Jaspers, that was the well-known contention of Hegel and also of Weber, who saw the modern world as coming directly from Western styles of thinking, of cognition, and from Christian influences. But Jaspers said, no, there are at least four major civilizations that all in the same period of time evolved different kinds of theoretic thinking. And the four civilizations that evolved ways of theoretical thinking, according to Bob Bella, building on Jaspers, were China, India, the Middle East, and Europe. In China, between 800 and 200 BC, you had the development of theoretical thinking, especially from Confucius and Lao Tzu and other Chinese philosophers. In the same period of time, you had the development of theoretical thinking in Greece with Plato and Aristotle and the Greek philosophers. In the Middle East, you had the development of theoretical thinking by the Hebrew prophets among the Jews. And in India, you had the development of theoretical thinking in the Upanishads, the Vedas, and so on. So Bella spends 1,000 pages talking about these four civilizations and how these four civilizations have shaped the modern world. I found this theory very, very interesting, in part because these four civilizations are, anyone who knows Indonesia sees them everywhere in Indonesia. These four civilizations are deeply embedded in Indonesian culture. In China, in Indonesia, Indonesians, I think most Indonesians have Chinese blood, which makes it kind of ironic that there's been as much prejudice against Chinese and Indonesians. Abdurrahman Wahid, or Gus Dur, famously made the statement, "My ancestors were pure Chinese." but I think the same could probably be said for almost all Indonesians, since people migrated from southern China, and now there is all kinds of genetic evidence for genetic similarities between people in Java and people in Taiwan. So anyway, but quite apart from the physical blood relationship, Chinese cosmologies, Chinese respect for ancestors and for the elderly, Chinese rituals, they permeate Indonesian culture and Chinese words as well. In fact, Islam was spread in Indonesia very largely by Chinese Muslims. So there's a link between Indonesia and China that is very deep and goes way back. Chinese courtiers used to put cloves under their tongue in 300 BC, and cloves only grew in Indonesia. So we know there was a connection there somehow. Secondly, India is very clearly part of Indonesia. Everywhere you go in Indonesia, Indonesian art, culture, stories, modern cinema, clothing styles, media, philosophy, Indian thinking is very, very widespread in Indonesia and is one of the anomalies of Indonesia. This is a picture of Borobudur, the largest ancient Buddhist monument in the world. That's just a 40 minutes drive from my house. But in front of it, you see a Muslim woman praying with Buddhist monks. And that is not an unusual thing to see in Indonesia. There is a long history of tolerance in Indonesia that is far, according to Tony Reed says that tolerance in Indonesia and Southeast Asia generally has a very ancient history, unlike Europe. So European traders who came to Indonesia from a Europe where even Catholics could not live in the same village with Protestants, or vice versa, let alone if you were Muslim or Jewish or any other religion, were amazed to find in the 17th, 18th century churches and temples and mosques and viharas and just right next to each other on the streets. So the idea of religious tolerance and religious freedom was not a Western import. It's something that is very deep and long-lasting in Indonesia. I have to go more quickly or we'll be in trouble. As the largest Muslim country in the world, many people are unaware that it also has a very strong and growing church. The church in Indonesia has been growing rapidly over the last 70 years, and the vibrant renaissance of Islam that's going on in Indonesia is accompanied by a kind of renaissance of Christianity as well. Also, a renaissance of Buddhism and of Hinduism and of Confucianism and now of tribal religions that are experiencing their own kind of renaissance now within Indonesia. Another theoretical stream in my book, you can see I have a lot of theories all mixed together. Another theoretical stream in my book is the question that I've had in my mind for a long time. It seemed like a lot of my students had not experienced disenchantment in the Weberian sense, the sense of Max Weber's that rationality brings disenchantment. We all know that rationality and modern science do not bring secularism. That's clear. In fact, religion is often the vehicle religion is the vehicle of modernity. So, theory that a progressive increase in secularization is an inevitable part of modernity is clearly not true in most parts of the world. The one exception being Europe. But what about disenchantment? In Weber's concept, disenchantment is when people no longer believe that they are surrounded by powers, by non-human powers, by invisible powers, spirits, powers in rocks, in oceans, in mountains, powers that are beyond human comprehension, miracles, meaning in dreams, communications from another sphere, all of that sort of thing. I had the question, it seemed like a lot of my students from different religions from all over Indonesia believe the world is still like that. They do not live in a disenchanted world. They live in a world that is surrounded by powers. And I wondered if I could find a way to prove it, rather than just stories, because I have almost unlimited stories, and my book has got lots of stories in it. But I wondered if, besides telling stories and examples, is there any way to prove or to discover whether modern scientific thought and rationality is in the process of bringing disenchantment to Indonesia, a lessening in the belief in spirits and powers that surround us. I was aware that my own bias was a Jawa-centric bias. I lived 27 years in Java, and while I've traveled all over Indonesia, not all over, not 17,000 islands, but all the big islands, all the larger islands, and I wondered if, but I knew that I had a Java bias, and sometimes my students from other parts of Indonesia would point it out to me, especially when I was traveling with them in other parts of the world and of Indonesia, and they would say, what you're saying is true of Java, but it's not true of here. So I was very fortunate to first have a loose grant that took me around Indonesia doing research, and then even more importantly, I got a very specific and excellent grant from the Ford Foundation that allowed me to travel all around Indonesia and visit and distribute questionnaires to around 50 different ethnic groups,